Welcome to Let's Finally Watch This, a podcast for casual movie fans who've always meant to watch classic movies. I'm your host, Nick Hayden.
And I'm your other host, Timothy Deal.
And we're in 1944.
That's right. We are moving along through the decades.
And we are watching this time, Tim?
Double Indemnity.
Yes.
So this is a movie that's been talked about on our mother podcast, Your Old Trains of Thought, way back in 2011, beginning of 2011.
And which I mistakenly thought I had seen, but I had mixed it up with Notorious, which I have seen, which was great.
Yeah, at that time, it was for a segment that we called Cinema Selections with Brian Churchill, and Brian talked with you about that, and later on, you wound up watching most of those movies with
most
him.
Of them, yeah. But that one we missed. Yeah. I missed.
And I had never gotten around to it either. So
this was great.
So this really was a good case of let's finally watch this.
Exactly. But before we get into the movie itself, Tim, give us a review of what's going on in 1944 in the movie industry, besides war.
In previous seasons, when we talked about the 1940s, we mainly mentioned about how this is still part of the golden age of Hollywood, midst of the studio system still going on. And of course, World War II in the 1940s, particularly the years we've covered so far, is the big deal. Although, strangely enough, I've realized, Nick, that none of the movies we've picked for the 1940s are really emblematic of actually what's going on at that time.
Now, is that because, I mean, are a lot of the movies that have stayed with us not emblematic of that time?
Well, I would say for this year, that's probably the case in terms of what was popular for the most part. If you look at the highest grossing films of 1944, they are all either musicals or war-related movies of some sort. Not necessarily battle movies, but movies that take place. The war is the backdrop.
Backdrop.
Essentially.
We just keep picking Hitchcockian or suspense-related.
Yeah, well, in 1942, we talked about Magnificent Ambersons.
Which was a fabulous movie.
Fabulous movie, but like,
that was Orson Welles.
Orson Welles.
So you can't not do Orson Welles.
Yeah, essentially.
I remember saying that that movie didn't go well because everyone's thinking about the war.
The war, and yeah. This was about poor rich people.
Yeah.
Then in 1943, yes, we watched Hitchcock.
You cannot do a Hitchcock.
Yeah, exactly. It was hard to pass up with Shadow of a Doubt. And this year, we're kind of continuing that, even though it's directed by Billy Wilder, Double Indemnity, who is a pretty famous director, but not quite on the same level as those two. Well, depends on who you talk to, I guess. But yes, it's not intentional. I mean, we could have. One of the movies we did nominate this for this episode was the number two grossing movie of the year, Meet Me in St. Louis.
Which would have been a musical, very traditional. Yeah.
Yes, and still pretty well known today.
Yes.
The top grossing movie of the year was another musical called Going My Way, which I don't think is as well known. Now, it stars Bing Crosby as a priest.
Okay.
And interestingly, I feel like these days, unless you're really big into classic movies, I think it may be more likely you might have heard of its sequel, The Bells of St. Mary's.
Okay, yes.
If only because that one has Christmas tie-in, so it gets played a lot around Christmas time. But that's actually the sequel. Going My Way is the first one.
And okay.
The top-grossing movie of 1944, but not as many people know about it. Our other nomination for this episode was To Have and Have Not, which was a romantic war adventure starring Humphrey Bogart and Lauren Bacall, their first pair-up. And it was, I take that back. I'm going to revise the past segment. We did not actually nominate Meet Me in St. Louis because our other nomination was actually Arsenic and Old Lace.
Okay.
So we had a couple interesting options for this one.
It was interesting. This movie, Double Indemnity, and our last one for 1943, Shadow of a Doubt, both kind of deal with sort of like the seedy side of good societies.
Sure.
You know, like, here's a normal life, but here's a couple people who are kind of
knock. Shady. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I can see that.
Which is just interesting. The war, you got all this stuff, but apparently a couple of these, here's the dark side of humanity.
Yep.
Are coming out.
Yeah. And this was one where it was a little tricky picking which one we were going to go with, because those were some other very interesting options. But when we were looking at the allocates that Double Indemnity has had over the years, like, okay, this one seems to be the critic's favorite among these.
Yeah.
I should also point out 1944 also saw the release of the movie Gaslight, which has become kind of It's just kind of our slang. Jargon. Yes, jargon about gaslighting someone.
Oh, it's from that movie.
It's from that movie. And that's a movie about a man who's trying to drive his wife insane to basically hide his own criminal affairs.
Okay.
Trying to convince her she's not seeing things that she thinks she's seeing, now, which is what gaslighting as in the slang term means.
So all these like thrillers and crime fiction, which seems like it's grow. I mean, around here, there's a good number of them. Is that all Rudman radio? Like radio, I know thrillers were very popular, and that would have been 30s?
Yeah, I mean, well, radio is still going on at this point.
But it would have started...
But yeah, that's a good question. I don't remember off the top of my head when, like, hard-boiled detective stuff would have really started. But I want to say it feels like a 30s thing.
So there's probably a synergy coming between radio and what's turning into movies.
Sure,
probably.
Sure.
I mean, I'm guessing.
For sure. I think this is a good time for us to talk, now that you bring that up, let's talk about film noir.
Okay, yes.
Because this movie is a film noir, but interestingly, it's a category that's it's actually kind of hard to define. Or at least it's kind of a nebulous definition.
You know it when you see it.
Yeah, basically. If you look at Wikipedia, Wikipedia defines it like this, or at least introduces the topic this way. Film noir is a cinematic term used primarily to describe stylized Hollywood crime dramas, particularly those that emphasize cynical attitudes and motivations. The 1940s and 50s are generally regarded as the classic period of American film noir. It's associated with a low-key black-and-white visual style that has roots in German expressionism cinematography. But what's interesting is that this is actually a term that is kind of applied retroactively. It was not even coined until the French critic Nino Frank coined it in 1946, which is like 2 years after this movie. The American film industries didn't really even pick up on that until like the 1960s, 1970s. Okay. Back when these films were first being made in like the 30s and 40s, and 50s, they would have just been referred to as like melodramas,
yeah,
that sort of thing. But just so I'm not completely relying on Wikipedia for my definitions here, I thought I'd double check. I pulled an old textbook off my shelf, a textbook that I never read when I was in film school.
called, were you supposed to read it?
Nominally.
Okay.
I think it was like toward the end of a class, and it was like the professor never actually referenced it. So it was like, okay, I'm not reading this.
Yeah, yeah.
I have other things to do. But anyway, this is Anatomy of Film by Bernard F. Dick. And it also admits film noir does not have a concrete definition, yet its characteristics are among the most recognizable of any genre. So I'm going to flip it back to its glossary where it actually does try to define it. Film noir, French for dark film, meaning a film with a discernible dark look characterized by low-key lighting, high-contrast photography, rain-slick streets, flashing neon signs, smoke-filled bars, mirrored cocktail lounges, sunless living rooms, femme fatales, and easily snared males.
So basically, Pottersville.
sort of.
I mean, it's like that. That's the one scene in *Is Wonderful Life* that's sort of film noirish.
Sort of, yes. Yeah. And the trick with even that definition is that not necessarily all those things are present to make a film noir, or not every crime film is a film noir. Yeah. But I think every film noir involves crime. So it's this gray area. It is kind of a vibe, and because this definition is nebulous, so there's a lot of debate among film critics about what is and what isn't.
But *Double Indemnity* is very obviously a film noir in the setup.
And a lot of people consider it one of the, I've seen some people refer to it as a definitive film noir.
Okay.
And one that, in part because it spawned a lot of imitators shortly thereafter in terms of style and things. Again, I would hesitate to call it the first film noir because there were elements from movies in the 30s and before this that had some of these same elements. But here, you've definitely got a femme fatale. You've definitely got the high contrast lighting going on.
The kind of the cynical crime nature of things.
Yeah, exactly. It definitely is a classic film noir, no doubt about it. And it'll be interesting later on this season, we've got what's called a neo-noir, basically a film noir that is made after, in more modern times, with like colored film as opposed to black and white. We'll get to that when we get to Chinatown in 1974.
We'll compare and see how.
Yes.
Compare and contrast.
Indeed.
Write a 5-paragraph essay. Go.
But right now, we're going to talk about Double Indemnity.
All right. Do any awards and things? I mean, you mentioned it got quite a number of them.
Yes. So it was nominated for 7 Academy Awards, but it didn't win any of them.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I mean, it was nominated for the big ones, Best Picture, Best Director, Best Writing.
So people really liked it, just didn't quite edge out.
Well, part of the problem was both this and Going My Way were produced by Paramount, and Paramount was plugging for Going My Way because it was the feel-good movie. Oh, okay. It was a musical. It was Bing Crosby. And so it didn't have the support of the studio. I mean, it won 3 of the 7 Oscars that Double Indemnity was nominated for. So there were other things, like Ingrid Bergman won for Gaslight.
Yeah.
So there might have been other, well, good winners too. But this legacy has held up very well. It was, of course, preserved in the National Film Registry in 1992, which is only about 3 years after the start. It's pretty early. So sometimes I look at like how early these things were inducted, and like it shows how important
it was for the film. Yeah.
Yeah. And it is on several American Film Institute lists, including AFI's 100 Movies. It ranked at number 38.
Nice.
100 Thrills ranked at number 24. 100 Passions ranked at 84.
Huh.
On their lists of 100 heroes and villains, there's 50 of each. And our femme fatale, Phyllis Dietrichson, ranked at number 8.
Wow.
Which is pretty high up.
Pretty high up, yeah.
On the 10th anniversary of their 100 movies, it bumped up from number 38 to number 29. And it is on a lot of top 100 lists of greatest films of all time, including Entertainment Weekly at number 50, the National Society of Film Critics at number 29, Time Magazine, no particular number ranking there. The Writers Guild of America ranked it the 26th greatest screenplay.
It's a good screenplay.
It is a good screenplay. And also it's on the list for BBC, Variety, and Time Out multiple times. So this is considered a all-time great by the film critics that be.
I think we'll talk about that, but I think we would agree.
Probably.
And we're the only ones that matter.
Wow.
Yep. You heard it here, guys. So, Tim, give us, for those who have not seen it, give us a quick summary of the plot.
All right. This movie stars Fred McMurray, Barbara Stanwyck, and Edward G. Robinson. Fred McMurray plays a insurance salesman who encounters Barbara Stanwyck's character, Phyllis Dietrichson, basically dressed only in her bath towel after having gotten in the shower. And Fred McMurray, even though we know him mostly as a
comical Disney lead,
live action stuff. But even at this time, he was known for playing just really nice guys. So even though the live action Disney movies didn't start until the 1950s, he kind of already had that reputation.
Okay.
But in this movie, he's definitely playing against type. He sees Phyllis Dietrichson in the bath towel, and he immediately wants her.
Yes.
In the worst way you can imagine. But Phyllis also has kind of this thing where she's kind of tired of her husband. Yes. And she kind of subtly asks questions like, is it possible I could get an insurance policy on my husband without him knowing it? And he's like, why are you asking me that? And he tries to put her out of his mind, but it doesn't work because he has seen her in a towel and can't get the sight of her anklets out of his mind for some weird reason. I don't know why. Okay, I'm not going to try to analyze that. But eventually, yes, she talks him into trying to kill off her husband in a way that they can get the insurance money together. Basically, there's a special way that you can get, if your husband dies in a very rare way, you get double indemnity, basically twice the insurance.
Yeah, it's like $50,000,
$100,000? Yeah, total for double indemnity would be $100,000.
Which is quite a lot in 1944.
Yep. Edward G. Robinson plays a co-worker of, the character's name here? Walter Neff. He plays his coworker, basically the guy in the insurance company who investigates claims and
make sure they're not fraud.
Make sure they're not fraudulent. Interestingly, Edward G. Robinson here is also playing against type because he was known for playing gangsters, particularly in 1930s Little Caesar, which was a pretty famous gangster movie.
Yeah, he's on the good guy side.
Yeah, he's the one who starts. He's the one that Walter is very careful to be able to fool, to like not tick off any of the obvious clues that this is a fraud insurance claim. But the question is, will they be able to get away with it? I won't go in too much deeper into the plot than that here. But yes, these are three of the, Fred McMurray and Barbara Stanwyck were two of the highest paid actors in Hollywood. Edward G. Robinson was up there too. I don't know about his pay rate, but he was very well known again as a gangster. And he had a bit of a hesitation about taking a supporting role, but figured, you know what? I'm in a time in my life. This actually kind of makes sense.
Yeah.
And all three do a fantastic job.
They do. The whole movie just rests on those three, really.
Yeah, pretty much.
Walter, I don't want to kill him. I never did. Not even when he gets drunk and slaps my face.
Only sometimes you wish he was dead.
Perhaps I do.
And you wish it was an accident. And you had that policy for $50,000. Is that it?
Perhaps that, too. The other night we drove home from a party. He was drunk again. When we drove into the garage, he just sat there with his head on the steering wheel and the motor still running. And I thought what it would be like if I didn't switch it off. Just closed the garage doors and left him there.
I'll tell you what it would be like. If you had that accident policy and tried to pull a monoxide job. We've got a guy in our office named Keyes. For him, a setup like that would be just like a slice of rare roast beef. In 3 minutes, he'd know it wasn't an accident. In 10 minutes, you'd be sitting under the hot lights.
But that is our summary. That's plenty of facts. I guess I should also mention real quick, we mentioned Billy Wilder. That may be a director for you're like, I know that name, but what do I know him from? Well,
that was me last week when we watched it.
Yes. Probably his most famous movies aside from this include Sunset Boulevard, Sabrina, Witness for the Prosecution, and some films with Marilyn Monroe, The 7-Year Itch, and Some Like It Hot. So he's got a lot of pretty famous movies under his belt, even though he may not be as well known for us casuals as much as like a Hitchcock.
Yeah.
This was, I think, his third film. He started out as a screenwriter, actually.
Oh, really?
Yes. And so this was, I think, his third Hollywood directorial job. And
wow,
so,
good job.
So, yeah, he was a good one.
Did he help write this one, do you know?
He did help write it. This is adapted from a novel by...
See, we look back at these classic films like, oh, look, everything was original. Most of them were based on something else still, even back then.
Yeah, that's true. It's based on an awful novel by James M. Cain, who had previously written another successful novel that had been turned into a movie, The Postman Always Rings Twice.
Oh, yeah.
So when this story was first published in 1936, the studios were very interested in having it, except then our friend Joseph Breen from the Hayes office warned them, like, I don't think so, guys. There's a lot of problems with this. So that they kind of backed off for a while until eventually it got republished, I think. And then someone at Paramount thought it'd be a perfect thing for Billy Wilder. And he basically worked with the Hayes Code people to basically make a workaround.
Because it's really about the morality and less about the showing anything. Like, you don't see any of the violence or anything, hardly.
Yes, but we'll touch on that. Yeah, let's get to that in our actual discussion.
Okay, put your 12 minutes on.
All right, we got to get our 12-minute timer up here.
This one might be a little rough. We'll see.
Yeah, I was thinking about that. This one might be the one that's a little bit more challenging to do that. Okay, and here we go.
From the moment they met, it was murder. Always behind them with his devilish hunches and his brilliant brain was Keyes.
The murder's never perfect. Always comes apart sooner or later. And where two people are concerned, it's usually sooner.
Could they get away from him and his relentless pursuit? And could they get away with murder?
You don't know Keyes. Once he gets his teeth into something, he never lets go. He'll investigate you. He'll have you shadowed. He'll watch you every minute from now on. You afraid, baby?
Yes, I'm afraid. But not of Keyes. I'm afraid of us.
So this is a story that involves a very salacious content, but it has a characteristic of a film noir is the narration.
Mm-hmm.
And at the very beginning of the movie, we see Mr.
Neff.
Neff. Yes, we see Mr. Neff enter into his office. He looks like he's been
shot,
injured of some sort. And he starts recording a thing basically to his coworker, his friend, a confession of sorts about, yeah, I murdered this guy. A dame talked me into it.
And you're close, but not that close.
Yeah. And so we know at the very beginning, he's like, okay, he went down a bad path and we already know it ended in disaster, apparently, mm-hmm. since he's making this confession. So, you know, that's kind of your setup.
It's your hook.
It's your hook, essentially.
All right, tell me more.
Yeah. So there's never really a question, at least I feel like a modern sensibility would be like to try to excuse this.
Or be like, I was kind of right, or you judge for yourself.
Yeah, yeah. That sort of like squishy morality. But, and maybe you could read some of that into some of this. I mean, it's always weird following, we've talked about this in previous episodes of Let's Finally Watch This, watching the
crime happen.
The crime happen. A lot of the suspense is watching the criminals put their plan into action and wondering, will they get caught? Or where will they get caught? Where will all this go wrong? And partly not wanting to because, like, they're the people. And I think that's one of the clever things about casting Fred McMurray in this role because, on the one hand, he's kind of a sleazy guy. But on the other hand, he's Fred McMurray. It's hard not to like him.
Yeah, yeah. And so it's an interesting movie because it's about crime and everything. But because you, at the end, you feel like they understood they were wrong. Well,
I think
The guy did. What's her actual... Phyllis does.
Yeah.
It's a little more ambiguous.
Yeah.
But that's kind of the point, too, I think.
Yeah.
But I think it is really, in some ways, I don't know if morality plays quite used here, but it is, it's really about right and wrong. I remember watching it, and I just recently been reading Proverbs, and it felt very much like that. Like, You got Wisdom shouting out, and you got Folly shouting out, and Folly apparently just
won out in this case.
Well, I mean, it's literally this woman.
Yeah.
Yeah. Not symbolically even.
Yeah. Again, easily in snared males.
Yep.
So I let her have it straight between the eyes. She didn't fool me for a minute, not this time. I knew I had hold of a red-hot poker, and the time to drop it was before it burned my hand off. It had begun to rain outside, and I watched it get dark and didn't even turn on the light. That didn't help me either. I was all twisted up inside, and I was still holding on to that red-hot poker. And right then it came over me that I hadn't walked out on anything at all. That the hook was too strong. That this wasn't the end between her and me. It was only the beginning.
But there are also, like, signs of him trying to make good, like with the daughter.
Yeah.
We didn't mention much about the daughter.
That's true. There's a subplot about the daughter of this husband who's going to be murdered, or that they're intending to murder, and her viewpoint on all this.
Yeah.
And I don't want to get too much into it because it kind of reveals some stuff. But our main character, Simon Neff, he feels a lot of guilt toward her, especially.
Yeah, he tries to rationalize, and it's easy to rationalize with the husband who's a horrible husband.
Yeah.
He's rationalized because he likes the woman, but there's certain things he can't rationalize away. And it's a really interesting character study, I guess. And then the friend's very interesting because he's like this close. And that's where we got some of those suspense scenes where you're like, any moment he's going to get caught. And you're like, is he going to get caught or not?
Yeah. Yeah.
And again, do we want him to get caught? I don't know.
It's a very weird thing. Like, the interesting thing about film noir to me is that it dresses these very dark situations in a very stylized manner.
And stylish.
And stylish, yes. I mean, they just look cool to watch just because of the lighting and all the stuff.
And they talk cool.
And they talk cool and all that kind of stuff. So, you know, it's that whole question of, like, is this showing too much sympathy for the devil?
Yeah.
And I think there's a possibility of that with noir, but I also feel like sometimes it's the example of shining a light in a dark area so that it doesn't have power over you. Mm-hmm. I don't know that. I mean, it's interesting. Neff talks early on in his narration about, like, you know, you think about all the stuff at work and you see all the people who get caught making a fraud and you think, well, you start thinking about how you would have done things,
like,
differently.
How you could get away with it.
Yeah. And that's something I think similar with noir and this movie in general, like this idea of, like, well, I don't really want to go into that world.
Yeah.
But if I want to sample, like, if what would it be like? And then hopefully it's enough of, like, it has enough tragedy to it that it's like, no, I don't want to go into that path any more than just this imaginary version of it.
And at least this movie is really, like, it is a tragic, very much at the end.
Yeah.
I mean, and it's set up that way. It has that sort of...
Yeah. Like, okay, what's going to be this man's downfall? And that's a big difference. And it makes it a little easier to talk about. Like, we're avoiding some spoilers, but we can still say that much without spoiling them because they talk about it in the beginning of the movie.
As opposed to, like, some of the movies where, like, the criminals get away with it and walk off all cool. And you're like, yay, I'm glad because it's a movie, but if this was real life, no.
Yeah, and we talked about that with The Sting last season, but I think there are other movies that it's even more questionable. Like, what are you actually saying with this? But in this case, and this is one of those situations where I think the production code might have been useful.
Yeah.
And drawing some limits in places.
I remember watching it thinking, like, some of the things they don't see, I think, makes it a better movie. You know, even, like, you don't ever see any of the murders. You don't even see the dead husband after he's
That's true.
Dead.
They keep it all off screen.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But in some ways, it does actually add to it, I think.
Hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
Or it can. And I think this movie made it so it worked.
Yeah, for sure. I concur.
Mr. Neff, why don't you drop by tomorrow evening around 8:30? He'll be in then.
Who?
My husband. You were anxious to talk to him, weren't you?
Yeah, I was, but I'm sort of getting over the idea, if you know what I mean.
There's a speed limit in this state, Mr. Neff. 45 miles an hour.
How fast was I going, officer?
I'd say around 90.
Suppose you get down off your motorcycle and give me a ticket.
Suppose I let you off with a warning this time.
Suppose it doesn't take.
Suppose I have to whack you over the knuckles.
Suppose I bust out crying and put my head in your shoulder.
Suppose you try putting it on my husband's shoulder.
That tears it. 8:30 tomorrow evening, then.
That's what I suggested.
Will you be here, too?
I guess so. I usually am.
Same chair, same perfume, same anklet.
I wonder if I know what you mean.
I wonder if you wonder.
Yeah, one of the
trademarks of film noir in terms of, like, again, there's shadows all over the place, light and shadows, but there's often you see shadows of Venetian blinds. And for one thing, I remember learning film school, like, that's a really nice way to add texture to your scene. So it's not just, you know, because film students, we have a tendency to shoot all our projects in, what do film students have available? Their apartments. Their door room. So basically all these blank walls, and that's not very interesting.
No.
But if you can cast an interesting shadow on a wall, that adds a lot. But I saw one person also say it kind of makes the characters look like they're behind bars, sort of.
Oh, interesting.
It's kind of these foreshadowing of that.
Well, that's the other thing, is like, at least the second half of the movie is a lot about guilt and what do you do with it? Mm. Like, it starts eating away.
Yeah.
Which is an interesting and I think completely worthwhile storytelling.
Yeah.
Because that's in the second half of the movie is really like, okay, I got away with it mostly, but not quite.
Yeah.
So how do I deal with this?
And that is, I think, is one area where Fred McMurray really shines in this one. He does a lot of great stone-faced acting.
Yes, very stone-faced.
Where he's trying to, like, hold in his emotions, his fear of, like, someone catching him, but the audience can read him. The audience knows what he's going through.
And it's not as, like, overplayed as, like, sometimes people in movies, they'll be like, given, like, everyone's paying attention, you obviously know he did it.
Some wide-eyed response.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, he's just subtle enough that you believe it. Fred McMurray considered this one of his favorite roles that he'd ever done.
Nice.
Yeah. And he wasn't sure he could do it, but it was a good challenge for it. It's interesting to me that Barbara Steinwick, is her character is ranked so highly on that villains list, number 8.
Yeah, that's interesting.
Like,
I mean,
she's a good femme fatale, but it didn't stand out to me that much.
Maybe because it's kind of a twist?
Maybe.
I mean, it's very cold. I mean,
there's a lot of, like, you're not sure how much you can trust her over the course of the movie.
Yeah, so maybe that's reason?
That might be part of it. But it's also one of those things that you've seen an archetype long enough that sometimes, like, you're just seeing the archetype and not necessarily the nuances of it.
Yeah, and she might have been one of the, I don't know, an earlier version of that.
Yeah. She's not the first femme fatale.
No.
But like I said, this inspired enough copycats. I think it must have been very influential for the filmmakers that saw it.
I do want to say, like, there's a good chunk of, like, it felt very, and it'd be amazing if the novel made sense, like, the insurance felt very real. Like, they knew what they were talking about.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, you would not think a plot about insurance fraud
but it was pretty interesting,
be that interesting,
actually.
But it is. The framing of this movie kind of reminds me a little bit of Columbo.
Okay.
Do you ever see Columbo movies?
Not really.
I mean, those are less whodunits and more Hal Ketchum.
Yeah.
They usually show in the first 10 to 15 minutes the actual murder.
Yeah.
It's usually some sort of crime of passion, and then how the murderer is hiding what he did. And then Columbo comes in, who's this bumbling detective, or at least seems to be, and he just kind of slowly picks apart the murderer's case. And you just basically, the fun of the movie is not trying to figure out, it's like, how is he going to string them along, keep them dangling on the edge of this hook until he actually catches them?
Yeah.
And so there's a little bit of this, except the framing is different, because I would say the, you know, again, the murder in a Columbo movie starts about 10 minutes in. Here, the buildup, the act two rising action is trying to plan what the murder is going to be. And then the falling action is more...
How's it going to unwind?
Yeah, exactly.
They may think it's twice as safe because there are two of them. But it isn't twice as safe. It's 10 times twice as dangerous. They've committed a murder. And it's not like taking a trolley ride together where they can get off at different stops. They're stuck with each other and they've got to ride all the way to the end of the line. That's a one-way trip and the last stop is the cemetery.
So it's a very different structure.
And kind of keeps, I mean, for knowing kind of at least the end to a certain extent, it keeps you guessing and keeps you like, what's going to happen? How are we going to do this?
Yeah.
Is that quite suspense like Hitchcock? But it's very, very compelling.
Yeah. I did go into this wondering, okay, how is this going to be different from Shadow of a Doubt in terms of, that one is considered a thriller, but not necessarily a film noir.
Yeah.
I guess because Shadow of a Doubt doesn't have some of the same characteristics. Like, I don't know that it's shot quite as dark as this one.
Yeah.
I don't know that there's no femme fatale in that one.
It's the opposite.
Yeah. So I guess it's a difference in terms of, like, there's enough differences that it's its own category.
It's not so much about completing the crime as just, yeah, it has different themes.
Yeah. It's a lot more about the guilt and the...
The small town versus this evil there and stuff.
Yeah. I mean, and this one, I guess, in some ways is more internal because it's more like these two characters, what's going on in their hearts.
It is much more internal. You got the narration and stuff, too.
Yeah.
Which is good classic narration.
Mm-hmm.
All right, we've got 10 seconds, Tim. Anything else you want to say?
I think no. I think we're done here. So, final thoughts here, though, Nick. We'll give our final verdict. Is this worth watching?
It is worth watching. I think it's first off a really good version of a film noir, and it's just a compelling story. And I think you could have some interesting conversations about guilt and stuff too, if you wanted. So.
Yeah, I think if you're interested in film noir, haven't seen it much, or this is certainly a great place to start. Like I said, the fact that it's on so many best of lists is notable. One other quote I thought might be interesting to point out. Apparently, Alfred Hitchcock himself wrote to Wilder and said, "Since Double Indemnity, the two most important words in motion pictures are Billy and Wilder."
Nice.
So
it does seem like something Hitchcock would enjoy.
Yeah, he would be impressed by. So yeah, I think it's a classic and for good reason.
Yes, I agree. That's the end of this episode of Let's Finally Watch This. Next episode, we'll be watching Seven Samurais.
That's right.
All 3 hours and 20 minutes of it.
Jumping to 1954 for Seven Samurai. Yeah, it should be
epic,
another one of our epic watch-throughs, but one that I've meant to watch for a very long time.
Yes, it's mentioned all the time, it seems like. Well, not all the time, but I hear it enough that I'm like, I really should watch that.
So hopefully you will join us.
Well, until next time, this has been Nick.
And this is Tim.
Adios.
Bye-bye.